I was born with a speech impediment. When I'm given a platform to speak, that impediment seemingly goes away.
My guest today has worked across tech, media, global giants like Google, Soho House, ESPN, IMG. He's all about creating environments where people aren't just hired, but they are heard.
I started taking on a leadership role within the Black Googler Network. My education background, what I learned in undergrad is, it's something that I think about probably once a week. Am I on the right path? Should I have done this? There was no one doing what I was doing, and the market needed it. Working in corporate is a daily masterclass.
What was it that helped you to be able to increase your risk tolerance to take that leap of faith?
That's a really good question.
How are you doing, sir?
I'm blessed. That was a fantastic intro. My heart is warm with those highlights. Thank you so much. But Chope, it's a pleasure to join the show.
It is a pleasure to have you on. Like, I always love chopping up with people and delving into their lives, especially when they're going to do so many different things. And yours is no different. And it's a place I always like to start is going way back for people. And I always say that, what were you like? I'm always curious, when you were between the ages of 8 to 10?
8 to 10. Well, first of all, I'll give some geographic context because I've also moved around a lot in my life. So 8 to 10, I was living in New York, in the suburbs of New York City, in a town called Freeport, New York. The Long Islanders who watch this will know exactly where that is. But yeah, 8 to 10, I love to play outside. I was one of those kids, you had to remind that the street lights come on at 6 p.m. So you got to be inside by then, because I was always outside, riding my bike, playing basketball, playing street hockey, baseball. I played all the sports as a kid. So usually I was playing some type of sport. But back then, my parents and closest people in my family would call me Young Preacher back when I was a kid. The church was a big part of my life, is a big part of my life now, and was a big part of my life then, and I thought I would become a preacher one day. So you can catch me giving mock sermons in the living room, or playing the piano with soul, thinking that I'm the hymn, you know, the pianist at the church. So that's what I was doing between 8 and 10.
Wow, did that come from just your environment and just being immersed in the church, or where did that, like, that tagline of the Young Preacher kind of come from?
Yeah. Both my parents were very involved in the church, grandparents as well. My uncle at the time was the pianist of his church. My aunts were pianists at their church. So music and ministry ran deep in my family for sure. So coming up, I was an orator, and the preacher, the pulpit, you know, the preacher was always kind of my aspirational goal. Was like, I want to be up there. And I remember the first time that I was able to read a Bible verse in front of the entire church, and I was so excited, and I just felt like, you know, I'm going to preach this Bible verse. I was literally just reading the words on the page that God wrote, but I felt like I was preaching to the congregation. So that's where it started, is reading verses at church, and you know, I have been able to give full-on sermons later on in life, but back then, what was the source of my joy was being able to be up in front of church reading verses.
Wow. And you said you played all sports. And I always ask the question, like, did you have a favorite? And if so, like, what did you actually learn from sports at a young age as well?
Basketball was my favorite, and still is. I love everything about that sport. And, you know, having worked in sports as well, as you mentioned, having worked at IMG and ESPN, even working in basketball was a joy. But what I learned from basketball is the role that each person plays in making the entire operation run. And I see it as an operation, call it the org psychologist in me, but, you know, sports is just another organization, and there's leadership, you know, there are middle managers, and there are the folks who are making the organization run, the team. And, you know, having played basketball at a young age and then managed the basketball team at Vanderbilt during university, operating in different capacities in basketball, I've come to understand the sport from every angle. And I feel like it's the most competitive and enjoyable sport and one of the most approachable sports, people of all different abilities. So I like basketball. I also play baseball and soccer, or you call it football. And basketball definitely stuck with me.
Who's your favorite player?
All time?
Yeah.
Used to be a big Dwayne Wade fan. Yeah, I used to be a big Dwayne Wade fan. Yeah, let's go with Dwayne Wade. And then as I'm a Knicks fan, and my current guy that I'm loving to watch is my guy Jalen Brunson. But yeah.
He's killing it right now. He's killing it.
He is. He
You
is.
mentioned being at Vanderbilt, and obviously you were doing basketball behind the scenes there and one of the operation managers. I was curious, like, even getting into Vanderbilt is one of the, like, it's a tough university or college to get into. How was that journey for you to get into a space like that?
Yeah, well, all thanks to God, for sure, and all thanks to my parents as well. We moved to a town called Scarsdale, New York, when I went to middle school, and Scarsdale is a fantastic town, and an even better school system within that town, public school system, and so that set me up to go to many different universities. I had my choice between Ivy League universities, some international schools, some top state schools as well. And I chose Vanderbilt because of the mix of a new culture. Vanderbilt's in Nashville, Tennessee, very different than the New York City Metro, as you can imagine, especially back when I went to school. Then you had SEC sports. And then if anyone knows college sports in the US, the SEC is the premier division of university sports in the US, from American football to basketball to baseball and every sport in between, the best of the best. And then you also have this really vibrant social scene between Greek life and non-Greek life. Vanderbilt really invests in the experience of its students. So it really called to me because it provided this well-rounded experience. It wasn't just like, okay, we're really good at academics, but we're not really into sports, or we don't really have a nightlife scene. Like, it had all of it for me. And that was my experience there. I got to do everything I wanted to do, from student government to club leadership to fraternity leadership to being a student manager for the basketball team. So, no regrets. I'm still very involved with Vanderbilt today. I'm now on the alumni leadership team for the DC Metro chapter. And, it's just been a fantastic experience being tied to Vanderbilt.
Oh, so you're also guest lit on your guest lecturer at Hampton and Michigan, right? As
I
well.
have in the past,
Nice.
I've guest lectured at Hampton and at Michigan, as well as at Howard University.
Where'd you find the, I'm going to say find the time, because as we go on and delve into some of the different things that you do, I'm like, where'd you actually find the time to do all these different things?
You make the time. You make the time. Yeah, I'm blessed to have had to manage a lot in the past, and I learned the exercise of time management at an early age. Playing sports, music, and student government at an early age, you learn to make the time and also plan ahead. So that's the best thing for me, is just planning ahead. And if I feel like I can't take on something, I'm quick to say no, because there's power in my no.
Where was the first time you learned that lesson of there's power in the now?
Yeah, I feel like in high school, once again, playing sports, music, student government, running a couple clubs, trying to get A's so you can go to a good school. You're offered things to do and to lead, but knowing when you're overloaded, that's actually learning to avoid being overloaded. That's the real skill. And I learned that later in life, but at that time, learning when you're overloaded and being able to say no definitely started in high school for me.
When I think about your journey from being a wanting to become a preacher to then going up to Vanderbilt, when was the shift, when the shift kick in for you as to what has now become your career around inclusion and creating these different spaces for you?
Yeah, I have to go back to my time at Google because, I didn't start my career in the inclusion space. And, by no means is my entire career now focused on the inclusion space. I know we'll get into that. But I felt a calling to use my skill set to make an impact, a commercial impact in the equity and inclusion space while at Google. You know, my career started in the advertising sales side at Google. Most people know that Google makes the majority of its revenue off of advertising. And that's where I started my career, is, you know, working with small and mid-sized businesses looking to advertise on Google. I then went to new business sales, bringing on new clients. And, you know, that was where I made my mark at Google in the very beginning. But one of the things I did on the side, because as you know, Shobe, I can't just do one thing, right? I started taking on a leadership role within the Black Googler Network, which is Google's employee resource group for Black employees. And, you know, started off with local, you know, just within my office leadership responsibilities, and eventually grew to regional and then global leadership responsibilities. And in the process of taking on those leadership responsibilities, I began to learn more about different, you know, global Black employee experiences. As you can imagine, you know, you begin to have conversations with people in Dublin, in London, in Brazil, in parts of Africa, in Nairobi office, in Johannesburg office, in the Ghana office. You know, of course, across the states, and everyone was having, of course, their own unique experience, but there were definitely some commonalities, some similarities in their experience. And then you began to talk to, you know, our sister ERGs, you know, ERGs for Hispanic and Latino Googlers, right? You have the employee resource group for people on the LGBTQIA plus spectrum, right? You started to understand what different experiences are, and you realize there's not enough people working on adjusting these experiences to, you know, level them out. And that's how I really thought about it, was, you know, the team needs more people to join it in order to have more impact in the space. And I was blessed to be proximate to it as an ERG leader. Once I finished up my time doing sales and partnerships, I knew I needed to make my move over there. A role was created for me to be able to do that. And the rest is really history. But it really started with ERG leadership, which, you know, now I always, when I consult companies, I speak about the value of ERGs, because an active and empowered ERG leader can be one of the most powerful forces for an organization's culture. But once again, they have to be empowered, and that starts with leadership.
Well, are there things that individuals can do that can help change that empowerment actually, or help to be a lot more activated? I know for a lot of times, speaking and working ERGs myself, there's always that conversation around, oh, there is no budget, or it's just a tick in the box exercise, all the different elements. When I've seen the flip side of people, individuals who are like, no, we're not going to take no for an answer. And they go out and they state the business case, they find the right sponsors and advocates, and they move things forward. But that number is a lot less, I can count on my hand, versus the amount of people who have the other side. So I'm curious, how do you get ERGs activated and connected in a way to the right people and power in organizations?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And, you know, with your experience, I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but a very simple first step for me is establishing some level of structure for your ERG program. And this might not be the answer that, you know, people might think you go to, right? But an ERG without structure is just an event planning organization. And if you don't create values, if you don't create policies and procedures, as you mentioned, stakeholders, right? Executive stakeholders, but not just, you know, names on a list, but responsibilities for them, you know, ways that they can get active. And not just, you know, oh, you're exec sponsor, you should figure out how to be active. No, tell them what you need them to go do, right? And give them kind of a playbook. I think once you create that structure, which doesn't take that long, and there are people out there who can help, right? But I think once you have that structure in place, it really just gives that ERG member, that passionate employee that wants to improve your culture, it gives them the toolkit in order to move your culture forward. If not, they're just going to be spaghetti on the wall. Maybe we'll try this. Maybe we'll bring some jollof for Black History Month. You know, maybe we'll do a parade for Pride Month. You know, they're just going to be putting things on the wall as event planners, But if you have structure, they're actually, strategists that are now working on your behalf.
And it's something that you said earlier on that got me thinking. There are people who, for want of a better word, hear the cry of others or see that change needs to come. And they're like, well, it's not mine to carry, it's not my burden to carry. And therefore, it's like, I'm doing things in other ways. And they just carry on, which there's nothing wrong with that. But there was something that struck your heart and kind of shifted your mentality of like, no, I want to double down and lean into this area. Like, what was it, if you can think about it, that made you actually like, no, I need to be the one who's actually bringing the change to this area and be the one that's making a difference rather than being like, nope, I've got other things to worry about or focus on.
Right. I liken it to, someone driving on the highway and their car breaking down, and then you're driving along and you're a mechanic and you know how to fix cars, right? And then you just drive right by that person. I'm sure it happens every day, right? We can't stop for everyone, as you mentioned, and it's okay if you keep going down that road. But occasionally, if you're that mechanic, if you stop by, you can really help and change someone's experience and change someone's day. And that's how I viewed the equity and inclusion work that I got involved with. My education background is in human development and organizational psychology, right? And so what I learned in undergrad is all of the fundamental elements that go into successful organizations, from leadership to policy to program management methodologies like Agile and Scrum. I learned this while I was in undergrad. So my core understanding of business came from understanding it from a psychological lens and from a human lens. And when I went to Google and I started in advertising and sales, that's my first love. I love advertising, I love marketing, and I will always call myself a marketer. At the end of the day, equity and inclusion, it really starts with communication, which communication is the umbrella for marketing and advertising. So I felt like it was in my wheelhouse. I had the skill set. I had the education background. I knew what I was talking about because I had lived it for 5.5 years before I joined the team as an employee. And when I joined the team, I was able to use my sales skills and my partnership skills as well as my education to have an impact. So I didn't feel like I could sit back because I knew I had what it took to be successful in the space. And the team at the time saw that. And so they empowered me to come join and even created a role for me, moved me to New York. I wasn't living in New York at the time, I was living in Chicago. And so they moved me to New York and, everything kind of fell into place back in 2018 when I joined the team. So yeah, the story wrote itself, but it was over many, many years.
How many places have you lived?
A lot.
I listen to you talk. I'm like, you've moved around.
A lot. Yeah. Born in New York, went to school in Nashville. I then moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan, after I lived in Nashville to start at Google. I've lived in Hartford, Connecticut. I've lived in Ann Arbor, Chicago, the Bay Area. I lived in Oakland, California for a bit. When I was living in Michigan, I was on a team that was based in Toronto. So I spent, a couple weeks in Toronto, then I'd come back, and a couple weeks in Toronto, and come back over the course of a year and a half. So kind of lived in Toronto-ish. And then I lived in London as well, as you know. So I've lived a lot of places, and now I call Washington, D.C. home.
As a, I know you love like traveling as well. I think you've been to like 40 plus countries, in your time as well. Do you have a favorite country you visit so far?
I don't have a favorite. No, I don't. And I would be doing a disservice to the places I've been if I chose one. But I do have a favorite city, if that helps. Barcelona, Spain is my favorite city, just for all that it offers. Being on the water, great food, great nightlife, beaches, cultural diversity as well. Leave something to be desired in how they treat people from the continent of Africa. But I do enjoy going to Barcelona.
Going back to your work, you did what you did at Google. From Google, you went on to Soho House, and now you're doing your own thing. And I think I read somewhere where you said that entrepreneurship was your first love,
Yeah.
but advertising was your professional crush.
Yes.
And it got me, I was like, that was lost. I love that line, but got me thinking around. That means for you, entrepreneurship has always been something that, did you always know you were going to go into that? Or was it just something where you're like, I might get around to it, I might not, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it was a maybe for many years. I think coming from the family that I come from and the background that I have, I think risk tolerance was something that I had to wrestle with for a while. And then also, I didn't know what I didn't know back when I was younger. So I knew I needed to go work in corporate for a bit. I knew I needed to go and get some more education, which is why I'm getting my MBA now. Like, I knew I had some things that I wanted to go do. But a few years ago, I just felt extremely compelled to start something of my own. A lot of people have been asking me to consult on projects over the years, give advice, coach, mentor, and creating a vehicle that allows for that is a business, right? It's just a commercially viable way of giving someone your time without being a part of another organization. And that might sound very formulaic, but that's the way I had to view it back then because I didn't want to have to think about like, oh, I need to get, a loan or go do all these things, start a business. It's like, no, I want to use my skill set to help people and help companies. Let me form an entity that people can, stick their flag in saying, oh, I'm working with this company, not just I'm working with Chris Clark, right? And that's why I created an Harmony Consulting Group, and it's paid dividends.
When you look at both the corporate landscape and you being an entrepreneur,
Right.
what are, in fact, before I ever ask you that, something said around risk. Your risk tolerance was a lot lower back in the day, and obviously you jumped into this world and that's increased it. And one of the biggest blockers I know I see people have is like, I want to do what you did. I want to move from corporate to start my own thing. But I am scared. I am petrified. I might not have any examples of stuff around me. Having that consistent income coming in versus doing business development, that's not what I want to do. There's so many different reasons why people just don't do it, but they know that voice hasn't gone away either. It's still bubbling inside of them. What was it that helped you to be able to make that leap and, I guess, increase your risk tolerance to take that leap of faith?
Yeah, this is a really, really good question. It's something that I think about probably once a week because, as many entrepreneurs will tell you, you definitely have these moments where you're like, am I on the right path? Should I have done this? Maybe I should go find a job that will pay me on every week or every 2 weeks, right? Like, so I have this thought probably every week at some point. And the only anchoring thought that makes sense in my head as to why I went out on my own when I did is there was no one doing what I was doing, full stop. And the market needed it. So when I started my company back in 2022, there was nobody that was talking publicly about people who had been laid off and offering support. And so I didn't see it as a risk. I saw it as me helping people who were in need. So I had to decouple the risk to say this is what the market needs. And the only risk that I have is that maybe companies would see me as an entrepreneur versus as somebody to bring in as a full-time hire, versus there was no money that I needed to exchange really to make this company happen. Of course, there's like the legal formation costs, but besides the few hundred dollars you spend to do that, there wasn't a massive cost barrier to what I was doing. Some companies, a lot of companies that people start, there is a cost barrier, right? You might need inventory, you might need a space, right? Physical space, you might need to hire a team. I didn't have any of those hurdles in the very beginning, and so I just went for it with what the market was going as my motivation, what the market was going through as my motivation, right? So once again, a little different story than some people who go into business for themselves, but that was my journey.
And how have you found it so far, having that, I guess, that freedom to also choose what you want to do, where you want to go with, who you want to work with, especially in this current environment that people operating in this D&I world that's facing a lot of backlash and pushback as well.
Right. Yeah, so you mentioned, DEI. When I first started my company, we were offering coaching to people who've been laid off, kind of low bono, pro bono, and then we were doing pure DEI consulting, working with companies who had never established any sort of DEI mechanism or were looking to do so with a bit more rigor and guidance. And so that's how I started, my consultancy, working with companies, big companies, local art galleries, restaurant groups. Like it didn't quite matter. It was if a friend of a friend or a former colleague or someone who found me on LinkedIn or Instagram connected, great. We can work with anybody, right? We're industry agnostic. And then, if you remember back in 2023, with the repeal of affirmative action in the United States, that definitely brought a shift to the comfort and bringing in firms like mine to lead any sort of diversity, equity, inclusion strategy development, right? To lead any sort of executive coaching program tied to inclusive leadership. All that stuff kind of went out the window overnight. And having been in the space long enough, I knew that the diversity, equity, inclusion pendulum would swing at some point. But to have it happen without the insulation of a larger organization, right? So if this happened to me when I was at Google, I'm sure it would have a different feeling than as my own, as a leader of my own company, right? At the time, I was blessed to have a very lean team. It didn't have loads of employees that reported to me. But we had to make a very commercial shift, right? Not in our methodology, not in our value system, but in what we were marketing to the world. So the way I've viewed it is having my own company, and that's just an example of one thing I had to pivot from, but having my own company allows me to make those moves, make those decisions with a lot more speed and precision than when I'm leading a global organization from a culture standpoint. And so that for me has been the biggest blessing because, of course, you have all these ideas when you're a corporate leader, right? And I had that opportunity to be in a senior leadership team at Soho House. And so you have these ideas on where you want to take things. And most of those ideas will be listened to, some of them will not be. And you have that frustration of, like, oh, if you just listened to my idea on this thing, things maybe could have been different. You don't have that frustration when you have your own company. You only can look at yourself in the mirror. It's like, I didn't do that, right? Or I did do that. So
It's all on
that's,
you.
yeah, it's all on you. And there are pros and cons to that, but I find a lot of pros in that because I get to work with people that I want to work with, when I want to work with them, where I want to work with them, and also get to say no sometimes. And there's no one else to hold me accountable, which I like.
When you were in corporate and you were navigating those senior leadership spaces and having the tough conversations where sometimes you get pushback, sometimes you win. What did those environments teach you that prepared you for what you're doing now?
Effective communication. I feel like working in corporate is a daily masterclass on effective communication, especially when you're working in the senior leadership ranks. I was having daily conversations with people who had chief in their title. And when you're talking with them, even over a glass of water or a cup of coffee in the break room, doesn't really quite matter. The way you communicate is going to have a certain flavor to it where you got to get your point out and make it very clear very quickly. And that's, I guess, probably the one thing that I miss too about corporate is just the conversations you can have over the water cooler, those water cooler moments, as they call them. I miss that camaraderie of an office, having a team under me that looks up to me and, I'm responsible a bit for their career journey. I miss those pieces because that's what gets me going as a leader. But to answer your question, I got prepared at Google and Soho House especially to be able to have conversations with founders, with business owners, with marketing leaders who had an idea maybe had some semblance of a vision of what they wanted out of a consultant or a growth strategist coming in, but needed somebody to take that, synthesize it, and regurgitate it back to them in a way that makes it clear I'm the person to take their vision all the way through. So that started definitely in corporate and has built exponentially as an entrepreneur.
Would you say communication is probably a through line for you and everything else that you've done? When I think about you from the young you, being a preacher is communication, and
Yeah.
how you kind of get the word out and the Bible out to people in a way that actually you can meet them where they are, to what you're doing in sales, which is all around communication, to what you're
Right.
doing as D&I. So it sounds like for you, communication has always been quite important, and you've just done it in very different spaces and places.
Yes, for sure. And it's interesting. I was born with a speech impediment.
Oh.
Yeah. And I It's one of those things you kind of sticks with you your entire life too. So I still navigate that now, and I have to catch myself as I'm speaking because sometimes people can't understand me, and that happens still, right? It may even happen on this podcast. I don't even know. And one thing that communication does to me, especially when I'm given a platform to speak, a stage, that impediment seemingly goes away. I think it's because I'm conscious of the message that I want to get across, and I don't want anything to get in the way of the message coming out. I'll give you an example. I was giving a training for at this art gallery in New York, and it was a training on diversity and inclusion. This was back when that was the core of my business, and it was hot. It was like it's been this summer. It was 30 degrees Celsius, definitely in the 80s Fahrenheit. It was humid, it was uncomfortable, and I was coming in to this art gallery to give this training. And the room that they had us training in was nice, but the air conditioning wasn't blasting. So I was hot, I was uncomfortable. I had to give this 2-hour training to this group of employees who, a lot of them didn't want to be there. And I just felt this spirit pushing me, saying, it doesn't matter how tired you are, and fatigue is one of the things that impacts speech impediments. If you haven't consumed enough water, or if you're tired, it can exacerbate your impediment. And so I'm just there, I'm in front of this room, and I don't know where this energy came from. It had to be come from God himself, but I just felt this energy come over me where I was able to deliver that training. And that seems to come up whenever I have to deliver something, is that energy comes over me and I'm able to communicate effectively. I'm not somebody that prepares extensively for things that I do. I like to have done enough preparation over time, but I'm not gonna stay up all night to like rehearse or sit in front of a mirror and do all that. Like, I like to do my preparation over time. But it's truly God whenever I'm on stage, because all that preparation seems to come out in a cohesive way because people keep bringing me in to do things. So I'm grateful for that. And communication is definitely an important through line in my career for sure. And I'm still learning how to be an even more effective communicator. There's people on social media or who write books or, give workshops to thousands of people. And I learn from them more than I learn from anything else, because that's one of the things that I want to get better at every day, is how to be a more effective communicator. Because everything that we do in life comes down to, if you did this project, can you communicate what you did and what the impact was? That's literally what life is about. So that is what I'm always striving to get better at.
Honestly, like until you, well, even before when you said after, I was like, you saying you were born a speech impediment, and then listening to the way that you talk and the way that you articulate things, like you have a way of being able to connect the words in a very intentional way. Like I said, like this communication for you has always been that focus of like, how do I ensure that I am talking, I'm sharing, that doesn't necessarily get in the way. And
Thank you.
I'm thinking about when you said earlier around, you was once to be a preacher and now you still do it in and out and talk about effective communication. Are there other things that you have navigated as a leader when you think about it that you can share that have helped you to become the person that you are today? Because you come across very much like, with some stuff I've seen online, very much like confident. When you're in your zone, you're in your zone. It's like no one's going to shake you from that. You know what you're doing and you're just locked in. And that's not always easy, especially when you're navigating in spaces and places that can sometimes feel unknown or can feel shaky. So how do you always show up as you and not let anything else get in the way of that?
Yeah, and thank you for what you shared earlier. I appreciate that. I definitely work hard to be a communicator. That's one thing that I'm passionate about. As a leader, this question takes me back to my time at Soho House because that was the hardest role that I've had, even harder than being an entrepreneur, I think.
Wow, why?
I'm starting to tear up a little bit. Because that time, the way I look back on it, I joined Soho House in 2021, early 2021. And if we can all take ourselves back to that time, it was, we're still in the pandemic. Depending on where you are, I was living in London at the time, lockdown procedures were still in effect. But there was hope, there was promise. Coming from New York right before that, New York was opening up, people were outside, you can at least eat outside, right? Things were starting to open up. Soho House, as a business, thrives on in-person connection points, right? The houses, the hotels, the spas, the gyms, it's all about human connection. Even when you're on the app, it's about human connection. And as a human development practitioner and an org psychologist, being in that space during that inflection point in history when the world slowed down and people were inside, not interacting in person with as much frequency, and then working in an industry that thrives on in-person connection and being responsible for employee culture and member inclusion was difficult, and that is saying it lightly, mildly. The company had to rehire all of its furloughed folks, and of course, retrain and rehire all those folks. It had to bring all its members back. It had to restart as a company. And as such, you had a lot of urgency on everything that you were doing. And, I won't go into every little detail, but when you work that closely with people after not working that closely with people, like literally going from working remotely at Google from my place in Brooklyn to working in person every day with people who only work in person because that's what hospitality is. It just was such a shock to my system, and I can tell it was a shock to many people's systems because of just that closeness, that camaraderie that was built because of the journey that we were on. And I know I'm not directly answering your question, but as a leader, one of the spaces that I gravitate to is always the people side, the people connection. Like, what are people feeling and what are they going through when they're in the world of work? And because of all that was going on at the time when I was at Soho House, that was a heavy role for me because people were going through it and they were still showing up every day to work, but they were bringing a lot with them, people on my team, people on any in any role, right? Because when you're the global leader in of an organization with responsible for employee culture, you talk to everybody. And I was talking to the coat room attendant when I was talking to the head chef, I was talking to the person at reception, I was talking to the general manager, to the founder of the company, to the president of the company. It didn't matter. I was having conversations with everybody, and everybody had their own challenges that they were going through. And I was absorbing a lot of that energy while I was in that role. And so whenever I heard a yes to a project idea or a new initiative, it felt heavier than it ever did. But when I got those yeses at Google, when I heard a no, it definitely felt heavier than it ever did before when I was at Google, or even after as an entrepreneur, because I felt like I had the weight of 10,000 people on my shoulders who were going through it coming out of COVID and looking to make the magic happen for Soho House. So it was a heavy role, and I'm grateful for it. It's made me a better leader. It's made me more conscious of how I show up in the workplace. It's also allowed me to be an empath without getting fully wrapped up in the feelings and the thoughts of another person. Like, I can still show that empathetic connection without getting wrapped in, but it took time to get there, and Soho House gave me that time to do that. And so I'm very grateful for that experience, and it has definitely shaped a lot of how I show up today.
In those kind of environments, when I listen to you describe, and I can just only imagine that weight that you were carrying of all those people. How do you show up for them and also show up for yourself so you don't get burnt out? I'm not sure if you did or not, but I'm assuming that. How do you ensure that you don't actually get burnt out, you get dragged into that, so you can still keep on functioning as a human being outside of the workplace? And then when you step
Right.
into that, you can be there for the people as well.
Yeah. The unhealthy answer to this question is wine. Wine is the unhealthy answer to this question. I love wine. Wine is my friend. But no, I like to cook. Cooking has always been my refuge. Even during the pandemic, I went from cooking maybe twice a week because I worked at Google where they gave you food in the office, to working from home and cooking a lot, which was a blessing for me. And I really got to reignite my passion for cooking during COVID. It was a very dark time for many in the world. And for some of us who found new hobbies and passions, it was a time to reset and restore. And it was definitely that for me. I was able to reconnect with my love of cooking. And cooking has been what I turn to when I need an escape from what is going on. And, I'm getting married in 2 months. And so being able to cook for my wife to be is also a big something that a big moment for me in the week is like when I get to make something that we both enjoy and I get to hear how much she enjoyed it. Like, that's also a win for me. So those are the moments that recharge me.
It's important to have your own activities outside of what it is you do that is just completely divorced of your normal day to day, so you can immerse yourself in those activities. So you love cooking. Is there a crisp special dish that you cook that's your go-to kind of thing?
Well, what do you like to eat?
I'm very simple. I'm straightforward. Afro-Caribbean food, so a mix of jollof rice, rice and peas, like that's my normal niceties. Aside of that, probably Italian. Probably the only thing I can think of that I really like and enjoy eating as well.
I'm with you on the Afro-Caribbean foods. Being from the islands myself, making food from the diaspora is definitely something that I enjoy. It takes time, and I think
For sure.
the time is what I need often to escape, right? If I just go and make a very quick, like 20-minute meal, it's not the same feeling for me. That's really where my wife to be excels, is the quick meal, right? And they're delicious and they're fantastic and they're good for like a weeknight. But if I have an opportunity to spend 3 hours in the kitchen, or even like multiple days, like marinating something and then making it a couple of days later, I'm really in my zen. So my favorite thing to make is probably oxtail stew with the rice and peas and fried plantain, right? Probably my favorite thing to make. Probably quickly followed by curry chicken, right? Curry chicken. And for the Guyanese on the call, chicken curry. But it is curry chicken to me, and that's what I make. My mama calls it curry chicken, I call it curry chicken. But that's probably my second favorite. And then I really do like to grill. I don't currently have space to grill right now. That's my own, but I do like to grill. So, the multiple marinades that I'll make for whatever I'm making, whether it be pork shoulder or ribs, or if I'm making some chicken, like I like to brine and marinate and then get to the grill for sure.
I can see, listen to those meals. I can see why that definitely takes a lot of time of the preparation work
It
and
slows
everything
you
else
down.
that
It slows you down. It's like a mini vacation for me, right? Like I don't need, like I love travel. I love to go to wherever I'm going, to a beach or a new city. But cooking to me is like a mini vacation. It's an escape from the day-to-day reality, which I love.
Where has, I know you talk about Soul House, but where has your biggest lesson so far in life come from? Has it been work? Has it been home? A mix? Like, I was curious to ask that from find out from people.
Yeah, I feel like it's in my personal dating relationships. That's where I've learned the most. Every person I've dated has been very different from the other, and as such, I've had to learn how to navigate those dynamics. And now, as I head into getting married, I'm still, of course, learning my wife to be every day. But we have a, it's been 5 years now we've been together, and I have a deep understanding of what she values and what she cares about, and how I show up and how I can improve. And I feel like I learn best when I have, that time to really spend getting to know myself in the context of her, and her in the context of me, as well as her in the context of other people and myself in the context of other people. Like it all comes together as just a learning experience. So I learned the best from, my most intimate relationships, and I can apply how I show up in those different environments to professional relationships, right? Or to me being a mentor, me being a mentee. Like I know how I operate and how I think with different stimulus, and so I'm able to do that or extrapolate that in other relationships.
As an expert communicator, I want to give that put that title on you.
Is that a new
Does
LinkedIn headline for me?
it make it easier in relationships because you're like, oh, I know how to listen well, and therefore I know how to communicate my feelings, or does it actually make it harder?
I'm not going to claim expert communicator quite yet
Not
because
yet.
I have lots of work to do, but I appreciate the sentiment. Thank you. Your question really I'm challenged in answering it because the word easy that you used, right? I don't think communication with anyone, like I have a tough time with the word easy because it makes it seem like you don't have to put in any effort or put in like low effort. And I believe that everyone I interact with deserves a substantial amount of effort from me. That's often why I love to meet people in person, because I like to show the effort that I'm giving, because I like to give effort in every connection that I have, whether it be someone looking to be introduced to someone in my network, someone looking to meet with me, someone looking to work with me with through one of my companies. I like to give that effort. And so, yes, communicating and leadership and all these things, like I enjoy them. I find them to be part of my mission and my purpose and part of my North Star in life. With that said, I don't like to take the easy way with any connection. I like to be intentional with every conversation that I have, with most of the words that I say, because I know that it all has weight. And something that you might just say quickly or might say in passing could stick with somebody negatively or positively. And that's why I think it's not formulaic or fake or not genuine. I just like to give it some thought. If I'm going to put any sort of effort into something, like I want to give it some thought so that I'm coming off the way I intend to come off. Because as they say, impact and intention are not the same, and people often remember how you made them feel, and it sometimes starts with how you say things, but it's usually what you say that can impact someone and how they view you. So I take a lot of time to think through that, for sure.
There's a proverb that I really like that says those who guard their mouth and their tongues keep themselves from calamity or trouble.
Okay, preach it, preach
So
it. Okay.
listen to you talk, I was like, for you to be like, no, I'm very intentional about how I approach people, the conversations I have, the words that I use, and actually every conversation should not be easy, it should be intentional. Actually, I like that reframe. Because I think if we all thought that way, there'll be so many things that we should not say and we wouldn't say because we were thinking about the impact it might have on other people. But also to your point around just being fully present with people can actually shift so many environments. Because you're still like, I'm being in a meeting, I'm on the phone, I'm doing this. What you're saying to that person, you don't matter, you're not important. But for you to be like, no, I'm going to slow things down, give you my time, give my attention and focus, and which require sacrifice, which is why it's not easy to do, is really, really important. But that's what makes a difference. I think it's a very, very good reminder, actually.
Yeah, thank you. And I will say, my mom always reminds me that certain connections should feel easy, like Sunday morning, right? That song, right? And I do believe that, right? Like, I know you're heading on a boys trip soon, right? You talked about that, and that experience should feel easy, like Sunday morning. If those truly are your boys, like, that should feel really simple. Like, that connection point should just come to you naturally. I do fully believe that. And you shouldn't have to think as critically about what you're saying and how you're showing up, because we need those spaces to let loose. And I definitely have those spaces, whether it be with closest friends and, of course, with my wife to be. But I also find that I get a bit in my head if I did not show up with the level of intention that I wanted to show up with after that situation ends. I'll give you an example. I was at this conference last year in Atlanta, and there's a young professional in tech that came up to me, and she's been following my journey on LinkedIn, and she met me at this conference, and she was excited to connect. And I had to go to one of the sessions that I had signed up for. I was like thinking about, like, I'm late, I gotta go to this thing, I gotta use the bathroom before I go to this thing. Like, I'm thinking about all these things I have to do. And I wasn't as personable. I wasn't as considerate of the fact that this whole person had approached me and they wanted to talk and they had all these questions and they wanted to connect, and I didn't give them the time that I would like to have given them in that time. And of course, I had a million and one excuses that I said in that moment. I have to go. Like, can we talk after the sessions? Like, here's my LinkedIn, like, let's connect. Like, I said all the things that people typically say in those moments, but that didn't feel like me. And I remember sitting down in the session that I was late to, feeling like, man, I could have skipped this session and had that really meaningful one-to-one conversation with somebody that wanted to chat. And thankfully, I was able to find her later and have that. But that stuff sticks with me way more than anything that I read or any like really positive moment that happens. It's like the moments of misconnection often stick with me in my head, and I want to go back and remedy that. So if I can get it right the first time, that's the goal. That's the goal.
And as we kind of come to the end of this conversation, it's just been educational on so many levels. How do you define leadership?
My definition of leadership has certainly shifted over time. As of today, I define leadership as being intentional about helping someone else achieve the definition of success for themselves. That's how I define leadership. It's hyper personal, it's hyper localized. Years ago, my definition had to do with kind of directing a larger ship in a direction that it needs to go, right? Because I was thinking global, I was thinking big organization. Now I get to work hyper local, often individuals or smaller companies, right? So leadership is is about helping someone kind of being their compass as they navigate their success journey and being a part of their lighthouse, if you will.
What's your definition of success now?
Harmony. So there's a lot of conversation on this whole work-life balance thing. I challenge it a little bit. It's in the name of my company, In Harmony Consulting Group. But, I believe that we have to find a way to integrate work into the larger life that we're building, as it is the vehicle to enable life. God put us on this world, in this world, to be of service to the world. And, often being of service ties in with the work that you do. Even if it doesn't have with the work that you do, the money that you make from that work will allow you to be of service to yourself and others. So I look to find ways to harmonize work into my life and help other people do the same, even when they don't like the job that they have. Let's figure out a way to either make the job that you're in better, or find something else that will make you have this feeling of harmony. So success today feels like harmony. And to make it less woo-woo-y, it's this feeling that when I wake up in the morning and when I go to bed at night, I know exactly what I need to do and I want to do those things. And there's never a feeling like dread that I have to go and do something. That's, for me, is success. Because there's a lot of other things that you can put success on. It could be money, it could be material things, where you live, who you live with. You can put success in a lot of different categories, but those things are not fully in your control. But I can control how I'm showing up to everything I need to go do, and my thought process as I'm doing it. I can control that. And if I'm able to go through a day, going to bed at night, reflecting on the day, saying, I got things done and I enjoyed, getting through my task list, that's a successful day for me. That's all I need.
I'm a massive fan of the conversations around harmony. It's something that I talk about a lot on LinkedIn and on previous, because like work-life balance for me just doesn't work and it's a fallacy. In fact, that's one of my keynote talks. So when you started talking about harmony and integration, I was just smiling inside. I was like, I didn't even know this, but this is one of the many reasons why I really like you.
Yeah, likewise, my brother. Likewise, my brother.
It's so aligned in so many different things. So that is really dope. And it's actually listening throughout this conversation, just great to see how constantly you've talked about things are changing and shifting for you. The definition of this has changed, my realization about that has changed. And for me, it strikes me so much around when I talk about being an everyday leader, it's that recognition that actually you are constantly learning and growing and evolving, and we are never fixed. But while we are learning, growing, and evolving, there's so many different things that we are learning that we can actually share with other people and also make an impact on other people, which you've demonstrated so many instances throughout your career so far of how you've been able to do that. And there's still so much more to come. So really appreciate you just coming on and just sharing some of your journey and your story. Like, I know I've definitely got a lot from me. I know people listening are definitely going to do that as well.
I hope so, and I appreciate the way you tie that together. It's a journey, it's a daily journey, and I learned from the content that you put out there. When you had reached out, I had a chance to subscribe to your YouTube and learn from the conversations that you've facilitated, and that has shaped my leadership journey, right? Because learning from other leaders is probably the fastest way to improve as a leader yourself. And currently, I'm enrolled in an executive MBA program where I'm side by side with some of the foremost kind of corporate leaders and get to learn every single day from a cohort. And so it's just a blessing to have access to so much content, to thought leaders like yourself, to functional leaders. We just have such access to these people these days that we have no excuse in developing our leadership mindset every single day. No excuse.
Where can people connect with you, work with you? What's the best way to do that?
Yeah, reach out to me directly. I'm on LinkedIn, Chris Clark. A lot of Chris Clarks out there. If you type in Chris Clark in Harmony, Chris Clark Google, Chris Clark Soho House, I'm sure it'll pop up. So please connect with me there. My other ways, I'm always happy to connect more socially as well. I think so we put too much emphasis in separating like our social means from our professional means. And if that's your thing, that's fine. But I don't do that personally. If you want to follow up with me on Instagram, I'm cool with that too. Chris Clark 24/7. And then email address. I receive emails all the time. People just wanted to put some time in. So chris@inharmonyconsulting.com is my direct email.
And all those details I'll definitely make sure that are available in the show notes as well, so you can connect with Chris because you've got a little taste of what it's like. So getting that on a bigger and wider scale, something that are brilliant for both individuals but also organizations who are looking to actually shape the minds of the future. The people who have been doing it and are very intentional about it can definitely help you take it to that next level. People like
Right.
Chris and his organization. So I highly recommend that you do that.
Thank you.
This is Everyday Leadership. We will see you all next week.